Do you remember the Staples commercials that was easy? You know, the button that you push and then the button says, I've got one at home. And it's a reminder to me when I start feeling like, oh, life can be easy. Yet last week and this week we talked about money, and sometimes our attitudes about money can make things seem awfully difficult too. So we're going to take a look at that a little more closely again today. We did start our prosperity class this past week, and before we got into the material, I asked people, how would you define prosperity? And overwhelmingly, the answer that came back was, you know, kind of the same, and it was that there's enough, that you don't have to worry about having enough, that it's there, it's always enough. That's a wonderful feeling, and it helps to be free. It helps feel easy. It helps life feel easy when there is enough. Who feels like there's enough all the time? Good for you. Good. I do often, most often, but there are times when something will come along and it'll bounce me back into that, what if there's not enough time, or I'm going to be late, or, you know, what if I, you know, it bumps me back into that place. When we talked about that, having enough, another word I think one could use is sufficiency. Now, it's enough. All sufficiency. And that's what we would like to do. That's what we would like to have is the sufficiency. Lynn Twiss, the author of the book The Soul of Money that we're using in the class, talked about scarcity. We talked last week about what she calls the lie of scarcity, how that feeling of not enough can be very pervasive. She mentioned that there are three toxic myths around scarcity that keep us from feeling like it's enough, that keep us from feeling prosperous, that keep us entrenched in that fear place, in that place of, oh my gosh, you know, it's not going to be enough. Those three toxic myths are, there's not enough, more is better, and that's just the way it is. When we consider scarcity versus sufficiency, I think that we have to get rid of these three in our minds. We have to get rid of these three toxic myths if we're going to feel sufficiency, if we're going to, in all aspects of our life, feel like there's enough, have that belief and that trust. So I'm going to share a little bit of what she says about each of these myths. The first toxic myth, there's not enough. There's not enough becomes the reason we do work that brings us down, or the reason we do things to each other that we're not proud of. There's not enough generates a fear that drives us to make sure that we're not the person, or our loved ones aren't the people who get crushed, marginalized, or left out. Once we define our world as deficient, the total of our life energy, everything we think, everything we say, and everything we do, particularly with money, becomes an expression of an effort to overcome this sense of lack and the fear of losing to others or being left out. If there's not enough for everyone, then taking care of yourself and your own, even at others' expense, seems unfortunate but unavoidable and somehow valid. Pretty typical, I think. I believe that there is that sense of, there's just so much and I got to get mine. And I've got to take care of mine. I've got to protect mine. It seems to be widely, very predominant, widely spread in our culture. There's not enough. The second toxic myth is more is better. And she says, more of anything is better than what we have. It's a logical response if you fear there's not enough. But more is better drives a competitive culture of accumulation, acquisition, and greed that only heightens fears and quickens the pace of the race. More is better. Some of you may be able to relate. My grandparents and my parents lived through the Great Depression. After my grandparents died, my uncle continued to live in the house that they had lived in all those years. But we came, you know, he needed help to kind of clean out some of the things. I found a ball of string that was probably at least this big, just plain string, you know. And looking at it, I could see that there were little tiny pieces of string. Grandma used to get the paper tied with a piece of string. She would tie that little piece of string onto the end of the thing. It comes not from greed, but of fear that there isn't enough, and you know, and so you just accumulate. I call it just in case. No. Well, just in case, filtered down from my grandparents, through my parents to me, and I fight all the time at just in case. You know, I'll keep this just in case. You know, it comes from fear. More is better. It's when we are in that fear place, it's easy to see that if I'm going to have something, I'm going to have to make sure that I get it, number one, and that I have enough for the just-in-case kind of scenarios. And then toxic myth number three, that's just the way it is. And there's no way out. There's not enough to go around, more is definitely better, and the people who have more are always people who are other than us. It's not fair, but we'd better play the game because that's just the way it is. And it's a hopeless, helpless, unequal, unfair world where you can never get out of this trap. Does it sound familiar to anybody else besides me? Yeah. Yeah, it's just, we see so many examples of people trying to get theirs commercial world right now is just rampant with it's just the way it is. There's just so much of this stuff in here that it's sad. I think it's sad. The hopeless, helpless, I can relate to. There's one thing she says. She says the resignation of scarcity sets in, and resignation makes us feel hopeless, helpless, and cynical. So those are the three myths. Our job then is to find those places in us where that pops up. That life, something in life comes at us, and we might find one that, well, there's never enough, or there's not enough, or I need more. We need to be able to erase those. And what happens is when we can begin to start recognizing when one of those beliefs pops in our head, that then we can take a step back. We in Unity know the importance of our thinking. And so the idea is by recognizing these as toxic myths, when we do see them in ourselves, we can, that is not the way I choose to think. I want to do something different. I do believe that there is absolutely a world of caring people who want to do good, who want to help, feed the hungry and to make peace in the world. There are lots of us who want that. And what happens too often, I think, is there's just an outpouring of resources, whether it's money or sometimes clothing. But does that good, those resources, does that always get to the people that need it? No. And I'd say often it doesn't. I remember seeing efforts after Katrina, And people were beginning to gather clothing to send down to the people who had been hurt. But even I saw all these boxes of clothing that they were getting ready to ship to somewhere. How are these clothes going to get distributed? I mean, it was chaotic down there. They were trying to ship people out and have, it just seemed like, is this really going to work? In her book, she talks about different countries and evidence of resources that people, well-intentioned people, sent. And yet, because of bureaucracy, because of disorganization or mishandling or corruption, even corruption, often those resources did not get to the people that they were intended to receive. I had an opportunity to do an excursion. A couple years ago, the Unity annual conference was on a cruise. And so, oh, poor me. Somebody had to do it. But I chose this excursion, and it was a Caribbean cruise. And we were in a boat, and the guide was telling us about the island of Haiti, I believe. We were cruising along the shore, and I mean, it was beautiful. And he was explaining that there's a lot of people who aren't educated at all in Haiti. He had, I believe it was a high school education, and he was one of the few that had that level of education. He said that most often what happens is fathers teach their sons their trade. And we, in fact, saw a small boat, fishing boat, with the father, and this father was teaching the son how to fish. So it just kind of keeps passing it down, the family trade, if you will. But there's little education. It's a very poor country. Some of the people on the boat that he was guiding or telling us all this information, some of the people said, well, how can we help? Where would we send money? And he said, don't send money. No, find somebody specific to send it to and make it a specific request, because otherwise, you know, the powers that be get the money and pocket it. It doesn't go to the people. So just throwing resources at a problem most often doesn't work. So there's got to be another answer. If we want to do something, if we want to help end world hunger or help in any area, there's got to be something different. She had a wonderful story about a small country, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. I think it was Senegal in Africa. A very small country, it sounds like, and much of it is in the desert. And in the book, she talks about how, I think she was on the World Hunger Project at that time, and she and there were 18 of them went to a very remote village in the desert in this country of Senegal. The people had requested that they come. They were having a pretty significant crisis in that their wells were going dry. And so they had asked the World Hunger people to come and talk with them and help them. So Lynn Twist describes this journey to meet with these people. And she talks about how it was so very hot. You know, it's Africa in the desert, and it was windy, but it was blowing up all this very, very fine sand. It was so, so dry. They had to wear, handkerchiefs or masks to keep from breathing in all of that sand and dust and so forth. And just very arid, very dry. They drove along, and then they began to hear drums. And shortly after that, they could see, off in the distance, they could see people. You know, that there was the village. And they could see that the people were dancing to the drums. And when the people noticed the cars, the trucks and cars, you know, that they were coming in, celebration and yelling, and they started running toward the trucks, the cars. This is not really what they were expecting. She writes that they were kind of expecting to find a people who were like downtrodden and poor and maybe, you know, looking like they were in bad shape. But instead, they found the people who were celebrating their arrival. They were being very hospitable. They were proud people and independent and confident. They didn't have education necessarily, but they were a people who had asked these project people to come and talk with them about their problem. So after all of the introductory things and the celebration things, then it was time to sit down for the meeting. Lynn Twist talks about how in the inner circle, apparently the people were Muslim, and the men were comprised most of the inner circle, along with the people from the project. And then on the outer circle were the women. They were there, but they were the outer circle. The men very clearly and directly described the problem, and it was that they had wells, but they were drying up. And so they were getting quickly to a place where they were going to have to do something to maintain the lifestyle and the lives that they had in this place. They wondered if, you know, they called this group in to see if they couldn't help them find a solution to the scarcity of water. Lynn Twist writes that she could sense the presence, the power of the women behind her. So she asked if it would be all right for her to meet with the women separately. And the men agreed. So the women in her group and the women of the tribe sat down separately together with a translator. It turns out that the women, some of them had had visions, but the women wholeheartedly believed that there was a great lake under the ground, that it was deeper than these wells that had been dug before. But according to their culture, the women could not dig. That wasn't work that they were allowed to do. So they weren't interested in, you know, bulldozers coming in necessarily or somebody coming to save them. They were interested only in, help us convince the men that it's okay to dig. That's what the group set about doing. So they had these discussions, and at long last, then the men of the village agreed to let the digging begin, and some of the project people helped. And the women dug. They used their hands, they used simple tools, whatever they had, and they dug, and they did it cheerfully, and they did it from a place of, I know it's there. You know, it wasn't like, oh, I hope there's water. I know it's there. It's just, when are we going to get to it? And they did. They did get to a lake. There was a huge body of water under there. They tapped into it, and it did change the lives of the people in the village. They were able then to use that as their source. And not only did it help that village, but I think it said like 16 or 17 other villages in the area all were able to drill then or dig and go down and find access to this great body of water. So the solution wasn't what one might think of, okay, we need to figure out a way to get some food and some water into this remote location. What they did was they listened to the people. They listened, in this case, to the women. One thing that changed dramatically as a result of that is that the women in that village thereafter had a very active part in the processes of the village. They were no longer kept outside. They became a part of decision-making and all that. So sufficiency is something that it might be unique for each situation. It isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all for each situation. Sufficiency means that we want to, in her words, reclaim the power of what there is. Of what there is. She has a list of what it would be like to live in enough, to live in sufficiency. And first of all, she says that it is an experience. When I think of what an experience is, I think of how do I feel about something? You know, how is this impacting me? An experience of something is is in some cases mindfulness. It's being aware in the present moment of what's happening. So for us to experience sufficiency, we just need to be present in this moment. And I think underpinning all of that, to live in sufficiency means to have a focus of what is there, of what is already there. What do we already have? And then treasure that and steward it. Meaning do the best you can with what you've got there. The people didn't believe they had enough of everything. They understood, recognized that they were getting short on water. Lynn Twist says that she's not one to say that there is enough food in India, or that there aren't hungry people in India, or there's a scarcity of water in Africa. Those things exist. But the difference is treasure what you do have and steward it. And like these other people, then look for solutions. Living in enough is a consciousness, she says. It is living in that place, having the mindset of enough. This comes easily for us as Unity Truth students, I believe, because this is what we've been taught, and here's how the two connect. We have learned and have been taught to believe. Sometimes it's hard with those toxic myths out there, but we have been taught to believe that God is substance, everywhere present, and that we, by aligning ourselves with the divine, will be able to manifest. So that's essentially what she's saying here, this consciousness, choosing our thoughts about what is, what we have, what we want. And then finally, she says, living in enough is a way then of beginning to learn to use money in ways that will, she says, express value, not determine it. And that's going to be kind of our emphasis next week. If then we know that the scarcity is a lie, if we know that these three toxic myths, there's not enough, I already forgot them, more is better, and that's just the way it is, if we can remove those from our lives, and then we begin to live in this consciousness of sufficiency, then what do? And how can we get to a place where we are like that tribe that just asked for help? We saw a video at class, and one of the statements I really liked that I heard on that video, and it was a statement by Gandhi. And it, when asked, do you really believe that there is enough for everyone? His answer was, yes, I believe there is enough for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. So it's very true. So next week, what I want for us to do is to, during this week, I'd like for us to practice this idea of living in enough, to practice a mindset of sufficiency, to put aside those, when those things come up, to go, oh, that's that old, and set it aside, and to practice the belief, try to center ourselves in that belief that there is always enough. And then next week we're going to talk about generosity. So then we will begin to look at how we can use our thoughts, what we do have, become stewards, and how generosity can begin to shift the way things appear in our world. And for now, let's do what we do each week and take some time to what I call practice the presence. So I would invite you to get comfortable in your seat, allow yourself to relax, to let go. If you're comfortable doing so, gently close your outer eyes as you relax and let the seat fully support you. Very often, if and when we find ourselves in a place of fear, of not enough, of whatever, we can sense in our bodies that we tighten up, we tense up, and we seem to live in a place of tension. But here and now, we let go. From the tops of our heads, through our entire bodies, to the bottoms of our feet, we consciously and purposely let go. We relax. And often our brain wants to begin its chatter. And when our bodies are still, it seems to think it needs to fill the void. So often, just to give our brains, our minds, something to focus on, we focus on the breath. And so I invite you to do that now. Bring your awareness to your body as it breathes in the air, holds it, and releases. Allow this next breath to be a deep one, breathing in and release. Let your mind stay on the inflow and the outflow of the breath, just noticing it. If you find those thoughts wanting to pop in, just let them be, but bring your attention back to the breath. And as we do so, we begin to be in a listening mode. We purposely bring our attention within. We let go of all of yesterday and tomorrow and become totally present now. And we breathe. When we do so, we find, as Daniel Neimad said in his song a little earlier, when we go inside, we find peace, and we find joy, and we find love. The very essence of us, in truth, is that higher self. It is the part of us that goes on after the body dies. Our real self is this indwelling divinity. And it is when we do this, when we take time to become still and listen, just be, that we tap into that presence. We find it comforting. We find it soothing. We find it revitalizing. And we find it energizing. In this place of connection with God, Source, the All, whatever your name is, when we find ourselves at one, we are able to relax and let go completely. we are able to feel that all is well. And it has nothing to do with the outer world. As we rest in this place of connection, we are mindful that we are given what we need. If we need guidance, spending time in the quiet will allow ourselves, either now or in a later time, to be much more receptive to the way that guidance comes to us. If we find ourselves needing prosperity in a financial form, when we come and be silent, we may later find that we have dreams or ideas that come to us. We call them divine ideas. When we are silent, when we are in connection like this, we can feel and we can experience trust. We know that we are one with God. We know that we are loved. And we know that we are love. And so as we do each week, let us now take some time in the silence to be with God, to be in the silence. We find these times of communion renewing, refreshing. And we know that God being our ever-present companion, that we can choose to align ourselves at any point in time when we need soothing, when we need comfort, when we need guidance, when we need wisdom. And we are grateful. We are grateful to be here today. We are grateful for the awareness of our relationship with our Maker. We are grateful for the ability to tap into that consciousness. And so, as we end our time of reflection, of contemplation, of being at one, we come together to affirm the words that Jesus taught as we together say and pray the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.